Welcome to Foxcast number 7. I'm Sung Fox, and this week, an interview I think may be one of my favorite that I've ever done. Because with an incredible guy who, along with his partner, really changed comedy in America. It's the one and only Tommy Chong, who's going to sit down and tell me the story of Cheech and Chong. You're going to love this.
In the studio with us is Tommy Chong. I can't believe you're actually here. You're a legend.
It's actually the great Tommy Chong.
The great Tommy Chong.
The fantastically interesting, funny guy.
Yeah, you are. And you got a book coming out called Meditations from the Joint on Simon & Schuster. When's it coming out? This weekend?
It's out. It's out.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it got released. It's in bookstores.
I thought I had a scoop. Oh, that's okay.
Well, they tell all you guys that.
Yeah, I know, right.
You're the only one, Joe. Yeah, right. I love only you.
We promise. But the thing goes from your childhood in Canada right on through your coming up against the Bush administration and everything. It covers everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a quick read, and when I started, well, you know, I didn't intend to do a book. I just write. I just like to write, and then Simon & Schuster, the ladies over there, you know, they said, you know, give us some, what do you got? I said, I got some writings, and so I handed everything I had over to them, and then they put it into a book, and I'm really pleased with it.
Well, you're an icon. You really are. It's quite a story. I mean, how many people live your life?
Yeah, I'm telling you. Well, I've been around, you know, I'm 68 years old. So
yeah, I was going to say.
So I've got lots to talk about.
Well, let's start back at the beginning. You're born in Edmonton. A lot of people didn't know you're Canadian.
Yeah, born in Edmonton. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, they can't tell us apart, Cheech and I apart, so...
Actually, I've always heard through the years, because when you've been around long enough, you hear all these stories, and when you hear them enough, you begin to believe them. But yes. I was always told that, well, Tommy, he's the smart one. He's the one that saved all his money. He's, you know, he's the guy. Well, he's rich. You wouldn't fucking believe how rich he is.
Cheech really is the smart one. You know, like, he's the most educated, and he won Celebrity Jeopardy. So
he did.
So yeah, he won. He beat everybody. He beat what's the guy with the electric car? Ed Begley Jr.
Really?
Yeah, he beat him, and what's his name? You know, Michael King, the one that owns all that, everything, King Television?
Right.
He's a neighbor of mine, and he was telling me, because I thought that Jeopardy thing was fixed, you know? And he said, no, it wasn't. And Ed Begley Jr. was on the same panel as Cheech, and Cheech kept pushing the button, and then Ed Begley said, there's something wrong with my button. and Michael King says, no, man, you know, you're just slow. Cheech had all the answers. He won.
Wow.
So Cheech really is the brain, but I'm the guy. I'll tell you how smart I am. My wife handles all my business, so that's my genius.
Well, actually, I didn't know this, but I did a little study up on you, and I didn't know you directed all the movies.
Yeah. I did.
But the first one, well, who took it? Lou Adler take credit for the first one?
He took credit, and he actually, you know, he was in the director's chair, but he was coming to me first, you know.
Well,
because
we
wrote as we went, you see, so he, you know, it wasn't like he had a finished script in front of him, so he had to come to me, and in the end, I have to take credit. I saved it, because he had a cut. His director's cut was so bad that Paramount gave the movie back to him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they said, we can't release that. You got it. He outfoxed him. He got it back, and then I changed the ending. I wrote the ending. You know, it needed a new ending, because Lou's ending was, it was all a dream. And you know how unfulfilling that is.
Yeah, really.
And then, so then I wrote the ending, you know, where we just go on to other adventures, and the rest is history. $100
wow.
million. Dollars. It grossed over $100 million.
The first one?
Yeah.
Up in smoke, that's where my money goes. In my lungs, sometimes up my nose. When troubled times begin to bother me, I take a toke at
all my cares go up in smoke.
Tommy Chong. Before we get to the movies, though, I want to go back to 1938. You're born in Edmonton.
Yep.
And you, after a little while, but first of all, you got quite a mix in the family. Your father's Chinese.
Yep.
And your mom is a Scotch-Irish. That must have been quite a blend.
It was a beautiful blend. Well, look at me. Very, very handsome guy.
Yeah, right.
Around the time I was born, my dad, he homesteaded. He had a homestead north of Edmonton. But he sold it before they discovered oil on that property.
You're kidding.
No, it was one of the biggest oil wells.
I bet he tells that story a lot, doesn't he?
Oh, no. He's embarrassed. He died a few years ago, but he was a very, very beautiful man.
No, he was alive, though, long enough to see your success, right?
Oh, yeah. He enjoyed the success. Although he used to tell me after he'd get off stage, he'd go, I don't know, son, you speak pretty rough. You talk kind of rough there, son.
What's the first thing you bought your dad?
I guess a house. I bought my mom and dad a house. Wow. In Vancouver Island. I still have the house.
Yeah, I got the impression you're one of those guys that really, really enjoyed walking around looking like an old hippie with rags on and being rich as shit, right?
Well,
come on, admit it.
The truth is, man, there's no one happier than a rich hippie.
Right.
Nobody happier. That's why when Cheech wanted to change the act, you know, like when we got together again, he goes, you know, we're supposed to do a movie, and they wanted to change it, you know. And I said, oh, man, come on. I've been doing this for 30-some-odd years, you know. Why would I want to change? You can imagine, I got paid. That's why, you know, people don't believe me, you know, when I tell them, you know, when I went to jail, you know, it was, I felt so blessed, you know, that I had such a blessed life, you know, because I've made a living talking about smoking dope.
Oh, yeah. I mean, back then, people forget, and they've seen movies like Half-Baked. But back then, that was the first time.
Yeah.
That was it. I mean, a movie about smoking pot. What?
Yeah. They had no idea what it was. In fact, we, Cheech and I, are responsible for all these warnings on the label now, you know, excessive drug use, excessive talk, you know, drug talk. Before that, they had no clue. And same as our albums, you know, when we started making our albums, there was no warnings on them, you know. So
right.
My funniest story.
Well, I don't know. The fact that the whole album looked like a big package of bamboo rolling papers.
But then people had no clue what we're doing with the rolling paper, you know.
Oh, well, you
had no idea.
You know how many ounces of pot were cleaned in between those double sleeves?
Can you imagine? Oh. Pounds.
Speaking of that, by the way, let's play a track from Cheech and Chong. Okay. I want to ask you, was Dave a real guy? Was that inspired by a real person?
Yeah, actually, I'll tell you the story. You want to play the bit first and I'll tell you the story?
Tell me the story now.
Want to hear the story of Dave down here?
Yeah.
It was our very, very first bit. What happened? Lou Adler, you know, the producer, he came to the last show we did, or one of the last shows we did at the Troubadour. It was an open mic night, and Cheech and I were like regulars there. And he came and he saw, he had heard about us, and then he came and saw us. And we heard that he was there, so Cheech phoned him up and said, we want to meet with him. And Lou said, okay. So we went for the meeting, and we went into Lou's office. And, you know, he had been producing all the Carole King records at the time. Mm-hmm. And so his record, he had gold albums all over his office. And so we sat down, and Lou says, what can I do for you? And I said, well, we want to make a record. You know, I looked around, of course, it's a record company. So, and he says, okay, what do you need? And I says, $1,000 and a tape recorder. and he says, okay. And he starts telling Cheryl, the secretary, to make a check out for $1,000. I said, $1,000 each. That was my big negotiation there. And he said, okay. So he wrote $1,000 each. And we took the tape recorder. And then we went into the mix down room next door to his office. It was a screening room. No. And it was nice and air-conditioned inside the room, but outside in the courtyard, the entrance was hot. It was so hot. It was about 110 degrees out that day. And Cheech So we're going to, you know, act through the first bit. And the bit was supposed to be Cheech knocks on the door, I let him in, we talk, and we talk about dealing pot or something. Uh-huh. So Cheech went outside, and the door locked from inside, so he was locked outside. And it was hot out there. And so he knocked on the door. And was like, he knocked, and I go, "Who is it?" And he goes, "It's me, man. I got the stuff. Let me in." And so then I was staring at the tape recorder, you know, and it wouldn't, the needle wasn't moving, and I stared at it for a long, long time, and then Cheech got tired of waiting. He knocked again, boom, 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 boom. And this time the needle jumped, so I knew it was recording. So then I thought, well, I'll start the bit over again. So I go, "Who is it?" And this time Cheech is a little annoyed. He goes, "It's me, man. I got the stuff. No, let me in. I think the cops saw me." So then I just never said anything. I knew the bit. I just waited and waited and waited. And then finally he knocked. This time he's a little angrier. I said, "Who is it?" He goes, "It's me, Dave, man. I got the stuff. Now let me in." And he said Dave because Dave was my first partner, and that was the first name that jumped into Cheech's head, was Dave. And I said, "Dave?" And he said, "Yeah, Dave, now let me in. It's hot out here, man." And I said, "Dave's not here."
And there was the bit.
He went nuts, man. He's banging on the door. "Let me in, man. It's not funny. It's hot. God damn it. Come on. I'm melting out here." So I opened the door, and he came busting in. He's mad, throwing his costumes all over the place. And I thought he was going to hit me until I said, listen. I played it back for him. And we laughed. We played it over and over and over for about an hour. And then we went around and showed it. Let everybody hear it. You know, and then Lou heard it, and Lou said, "Okay, we got to record this." And so then we went in the studio that night, and the next morning, that bit was being played across America.
And here is the beginning of Cheech and Chong.
"Who is it?"
"It's me, Dave. Open up, man. I got the stuff."
"Who is it?"
"It's me, Dave, man. Open up. I got the stuff."
"Who?"
"It's Dave, man. Open up. I think the cops saw me come in here."
"What the hell?" "Who is it?"
It's Dave, man. Will you open up? I got the stuff with me."
"Who?"
"Dave, man. Open up."
"Dave?"
"Yeah, Dave. Come on, man. Open up. I think the cops
Dave's
saw me."
"Dave's not here."
"No, man. I'm Dave, man. Hey, come on, man."
"Who is it?"
It's Dave, man. Will you open up? I got the stuff with
Who?
Me. Dave, man, open up."
"Dave?"
"Yeah, Dave."
"Dave's not here."
"No, man, I am Dave, man. Will you, come on, open up the door, will you? I got the stuff with me. I think the cops saw
Who
me.
Who is it?"
"Oh, what the hell is it? Come on, open up the door. It's Dave."
"Who?"
"Dave, D-A-V-E. Will you open up the goddamn
Dave?
Door? Yeah, Dave."
"Dave?"
"Right, man, Dave. Now, will you open up the door?"
"Dave's not here."
Oh.
That's the very first recording that Cheech and Chong did, actually, on all their albums and movies. We're talking to Tommy Chong. He's got a book out, just came out, called Meditations from the Joint, which we'll get to because he spent some time there recently. But it's about your whole life. When you were a kid back in Calgary, you used to, when you got some money, used to go, you were a big movie freak back then, weren't you? You went like from movie house to movie house.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what you did. I mean, it was very cheap. When I was very young, it cost a nickel to get in, 5 cents.
Oh.
5 cents to get in and see, like, you know, all the movies until you got a headache, you know. Roy Rogers.
Did they have the cereals?
Yeah, the cereals.
So you had a love of movies back then, right?
Big love. And all the Bowery Boys. That was the comedy that I grew up with. And you can see a lot of Bowery Boys in Cheech and Chong, you know.
Right.
And Abbott and Costello, I wasn't that, you know, they're okay. Martin and Lewis, when I got older, you know, they put me on the floor. Like Jerry Lewis used to just, I was, you know, you'd laugh so hard you hurt yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, why do they refer to the neighborhood you lived in as Dog Patch?
That's actually my description.
Oh, is
remember
it?
Remember the...
Labner.
Little Abner cartoon.
Are you saying it was backwards, Tommy, or what?
No, we lived on the fringe, and the fringe is that area beyond building inspectors. You know, the building inspectors would stop at the edge of the city, and then from that point on, it was like shanty town. You know, you could throw up anything, and it was fine. In fact, although my dad, when he bought the house there, he paid $500 for a little cottage, and it was in the middle of a field. I mean, that's the kind of houses, and they had tar paper shacks in those days. And this is a country where it got down to 20, 30 below zero weather.
I was going to say, that's Canada. That's that seems to me when the wind blew hard, you'd have to
outdoor
have
plumbing
a shack.
Outdoor plumbing, you know, totally no lights. You know, there's kerosene lamps.
Well, somehow in this dog patch era, though, moving along to you reached the age where, well, most of us were learning to masturbate. You were playing the guitar.
Yeah, I was 10 years old. I learned how to play guitar. Yeah, I really wanted to learn the fiddle, but I couldn't tune it. But I learned how to tune a guitar. And
what was your first electric guitar? What kind?
Les Paul Jr.
Really?
Les Paul Jr.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's classy compared to
that. I was about 16 years old when I got that. I played an acoustic guitar right up until I got my first electric.
I ask because I was in a band in the 60s. We played in these clubs down in the ghetto area of Grand Rapids, Michigan. We used to go across the street to this blues club. It was all black neighborhood.
Sure.
And those blues guys, they had some of the strangest guitars, like Kingston's, and with eight pickups on them, you know. I didn't even know where they came from, these guitars.
And did they strip the G string or the G string to give it that metal sound?
Oh, yeah. And every headstock had like 18 cigarette burns on it, you know.
Oh, yeah. I even had one made with the cigarette burns.
Well, anyway,
myself.
You started a band called The Shades. Let's move along to when you were actually getting paid to play, right?
Well, I hooked up with this Indian, a full-blooded Indian in Army Cadets, and he played guitar. I was playing accordion at the time.
Really?
I loved accordion.
You play a lot of instruments then.
Yeah, but I would always go back to guitar because that's what's the easiest one to play with. So I was, instead of accordion, I started playing guitar with him, the Indian guy. And then I met this black football player, Tommy Milton, and he was a singer. And he was one that we got the Les Paul Juniors together. Except he never played his. I played mine. Uh-huh. And then we had a little Fender amp that I used to share with my brother. He was a bass player. We ran the bass and the guitar through one 15-inch speaker amp.
Oh, boy, that must have sounded great.
It sounded wonderful. It had that fuzz tone, you know.
Did you use the reverb on the bass, too?
Oh, there was no reverb in those days.
Oh, cheap model.
No, it was not on the bass anyway. And we had a blues band, and it was hot. We were the hottest band in. And the reason we were was because the porters that worked the trains would bring up the records from the States. They were called Race Records at the time.
Right.
They're on 78s, and we would learn them. And we learned like Bo Diddley and all those, Muddy Waters.
Well, that music.
Alan Wolf, yeah.
That music inspired you to become a writer. You wrote Does Your Mama Know About Me, which made the charts in this country, right?
I got to tell you how that happened. It was weird, man. I'd never done coke until the day before I wrote this Does Your Mama Know About Me. And I you know, at the time it wasn't as dangerous as it is now, and I did just the tiniest little bit of coke, and I got that energy, and I wrote the song Does Your Mama Know About Me. Does he think the usual way?
Maybe I shouldn't worry, but I've been through this before.
Just the tiniest little bit of coke, and I got that energy, and I wrote the song "Does Your Mama Know About Me."
Did that cause you to go back to the coke to try to write more hits later?
No. I was luckily I became a bodybuilder before I was a dope addict. So I was always a bodybuilder first, and then I would smoke. Man, and also I got very low tolerance. You know, the Chinese in me. So I can't smoke a ton of weed. I can't do any coke at all.
Well, actually, you
quit that.
You were quoted as saying, if you smoke pot, eat well, and work out, you'll live forever.
That's right. That's so true. It's so true. I know guys that, you know, there's friends of mine, you know, that have been bodybuilding and smoking pot. He's a friend of mine, Zabo, he's 83, 84, and he's got a mind, you know, sharp as a tack and still nice. He's a little bent over now, but, you know, for 83, he's great.
I was going to say one more thing about your musical part of your life when you were playing at the Elegant Parlor up there. Jimi Hendrix was in the house band?
He used to, not in the band. He used to come and watch us. He would sit, he was an audience. He'd sit there and listen and play.
Did you give him tips on how to play?
Well, I never knew him then. I never knew him. He told me later that he'd come up. When I met him, you know, when he was Jimi Hendrix. At that time, he was Jimmy Jones. Uh-huh. And lived in Seattle, and all the Seattle guys used to come up and check out Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. Because Bobby Taylor was this phenomenal singer, still is. And so we had people drive up from California, from Los Angeles, would drive nonstop, spend the weekend with us, and then drive back nonstop. Wow. That's how good the band was. The band was phenomenal.
Oh, we're talking to Tommy Chong, if you didn't recognize his voice already. Meditations from the Joint, his book.
Well, I Chong is the name of the book, and Meditations from the Joint is what it's about.
Oh, the subtitle. Right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I Chong, right. Now, yeah, you mentioned Basketball Jones, so where did that come
A great from? Story. Do you want a great story? You got a time?
Sure, go ahead.
Cheech and I, Lou Adler's a big basketball fan. You know, he's the guy that sits beside Jack Nicholson's at the Laker game.
Right.
You know, the guy with the hat. Mm-hmm. And we were riding, Cheech and I were riding to the game with Jack Nicholson one night, and Jack, we were late for the game, so Jack pulls his big Mercedes on the wrong side of the road onto the oncoming traffic, because there was such a lineup to get in the parking lot, and he drove about half a mile on the wrong side of the road, and Cheech and Jack driving like a maniac, you know, and Cheech was in the back seat, and he's nervous, and he starts singing, I got a Basketball Jones, got a Basketball Jones, got a Basketball Jones, oh baby, ooh. And the next morning, next day, we went in the studio, and I says, let's do Basketball Jones. And he says, what's that? I said, you know, what you were singing last night. And so I wrote the lyrics, you know, the rest of the lyrics. And then George Harrison was in the studio when we recorded. So we asked George if he'd play guitar on it. And he said, sure.
Wow.
So he plays the opening guitar riff on it. It's okay. Very good. You hear it.
Here's a tune inspired by Jack Nicholson.
Basketball Jones, I got a Basketball Jones, got a Basketball Jones, oh baby, ooh. Yes, I'm the victim of a Basketball Jones. Ever since I was a little baby, I always be dribbling. In fact, I was the baddest dribbler in the whole neighborhood. Then one day, my mama bought me a basketball, and I love that basketball. I took that basketball with me everywhere I went. That basketball was like a basketball to me. I even put that basketball underneath my pillow. Maybe that's why I can't sleep at night. I need help, ladies and gentlemen. I need someone to stand beside me. I need
Basketball Jones. That's Tommy Chong and Cheech, of course. And I didn't know that George Harrison on
guitar.
George,
yeah.
Well, you must spending an evening with you must be a hell of a night. You got stories coming out your ass. I mean,
so many.
Because you hung out in Hollywood in the 70s, which is amazing you survived that. You really enjoyed being on stage.
Oh, man. When, the first laugh I got, I was hooked like a junkie on China White, man. I was gone.
Tommy Chong. His book is called I Chong, Meditations from the Joint, written in his recent 9 months in jail. We'll get to that in a minute. But we just got up to the movie part. Now, you went from Canada, being a musician, loving on stage. You met Cheech was driving a truck up there, wasn't he?
Cheech was actually delivering carpets on the side. He got $5 an hour for delivering carpets. And he was also a freelance writer in a hippie magazine. And that's when I met him. I met him out at the magazine. It was like a little LA Weekly or whatever, just one of those little hippie mags. Right. And a mutual friend introduced us, and he said that this guy should work really well on your show. And I was looking for a straight guy because Rick got taken away by his wife. And Cheech he was a little guy with a short hair, and he looked like a little Iranian, I didn't know. I had no clue what he was, and I didn't find out he was Mexican until we got to LA.
Really?
He wouldn't tell us. And, he just was, a straight little guy. He was trying to be a little white guy from L.A. But we knew, he was something, obviously, a little dark guy. And so he ended up, like, understudying. He was the understudy for Dave. And he did do a little bits on his own, but he ended up, when the whole thing fell apart, after 9 months, my brother, we were losing money because we turned the audience from a bunch of drunken bikers into some attentive theater goers. Uh-huh. And theater goers are the cheapest nerds on earth. They'll sip a wine all night or water. Or just have a little soda, please.
Perrier.
Yeah, Perrier. And, the bikers are, hey, bring another round. So we were losing money. So everybody broke up. And, everybody went their separate ways. The girls went back dancing, what they were doing. And Dave didn't want to keep doing it. And Cheech was the only one left. And so Cheech and I started a band. We were going to play music because Cheech was a singer and I was a guitar player. And I always had this feeling that I would eventually go back playing music. But we put a band together, and when we went to our first job, which was like in a big arena, it was like a battle of the bands. Cheech and I went up, and I said, well, let's do some comedy first. And so we started doing comedy, and we never did get around to playing music. Not one note.
So you're telling me note. Cheech and Chong originally got together to be a band?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You go down to Los Angeles now. You originally were going to be a band, but you, Cheech and you did some comedy in the world.
Well, comedy. Yeah. Well, when we went to L.A., it was comedy. Although I had my guitar, and every once in a while I'd bring it out, but it was comedy, strictly comedy. So when we got to L.A., I was still married to my first wife, Maxine. And so we all stayed at Maxine's place, and Cheech slept on the couch. And that's where we got the bit Up in Smoke, he woke up in the morning and stepped in the cereal bowl. And that really happened because he was sleeping on the couch, and my girls at the time would get up for school, and they get up, turn on the television like he wasn't in the room. And they'd eat their breakfast, and they'd be, you're going to be late for school. They'd do their conversation. Cheech is trying to sleep. And then, I had purchased a Honda 90, and so Cheech and I we'd get on the Honda 90 and go to different clubs. And the first club we played at was Red Fox's club on La Cienega. And Red Fox, I'd known Red from my After Hours Blues Club because he was a steady customer. And so he knew me from the band and everything. And we were good friends. And so I phoned Red, and Red said, yeah, come on down, man. He's got a club. Yeah. And he was out of town. So I went down there. Cheech and I went down there and we performed. For Norma Miller, she's another black comedian. She was actually in the Ken Burns jazz thing. She's a jazz dancer, a jive dancer. And she was emceeing, and she introduced us. And ladies and gentlemen, here's two guys from Canada, Geek and Gank. That's you couldn't pronounce Cheech and Chong. So many of the black clubs couldn't pronounce Cheech and Chong. It was Geek and Gang, Chi and Chan. They'd mess it up.
Now, did you go up the stage and do pot humor right from the beginning?
No. We did a lot. We were in a sex thing. You know, we did a lot of sex jokes. You know,
I was going to say, I was wondering what club would welcome you with open arms, and you answered the question when you said Red Fox. But I mean, yeah. So what did you start out basically?
We started out. Well, there was a group called Second City. You know, I had seen when I was on the blues Chitlin circuit. We'd go to Chicago instead of going to blues clubs. I'd go to Second City, and then when we were in San Francisco playing, instead of going to nightclubs, I'd go to the Committee.
Right.
And so that's where I got my roots. And Cheech and I would do Committee bits. You know, there's like Old Man in the Park and all sorts of these, you know, the surprise party for the old guy and that. And we you know, we did those bits. And then when we went to L.A., you know, Cheech and I had a big repertoire of those Committee bits.
We like to take you now inside one of the little pigeon parks in New York.
Yeah, Hoffman. Hey, old man, you just spit on my brand new khaki pants, cost me $2.98, man.
That's just my way of saying hello and piss off, you son of a bitch. I'm straight, you bastard. Go on home and change your pants. Smell like you crapped them for Christ's sake. Hang around me,
Hey, man, you don't realize who you are, man.
Oh, is that so?
That's right, man, because this is my territory, man. Like, this is my turf, man. Like, nobody comes in here, man. Nobody. The white guys don't come in here. The wops don't come in here. The space don't come in here. Nobody. I'm the leader of Sanchez de San Fernando, and this is my territory. You got it all, man?
Oh, bullshit to that. I ain't as scared of a two-bit beaner.
But when we went to Fox's, we did a few, and then we did, you know, some stand-up, and it was mostly sex jokes. And
so where did the pot part come in? What inspired that?
That came later. That came when... We'd been doing all these little clubs, mostly black clubs, and then we started playing the Troubadour, and the Troubadour was you know, it was like a lot of potheads and, you know, what do you call them? You know, Janis Joplin and right. Joni Mitchell and all those. It was a folk club. And so then, and they started getting our pot humor. But we were in the Valley in Los Angeles. And in between shows, and I said to Chi, you know, the first show went poorly because it was a dance club. And it was called the Irma Hotel, was the club. And they were dancers, and they didn't want to stop dancing to watch comedy.
Right.
And so when we did our show, we weren't that well received. Whereas in the black clubs, they were ready for a floor show. These white clubs, you know, they weren't. They wanted to dance. And so I said to Chi, you know, there must be a character you can do that, you know, that can relate to these people. And he said, yeah. He knew. He said, yeah, there is one, but I don't want to do it. I said, why? He said, well, it's kind of, you know, detrimental to the Chicano community. And what it is that all the Chicanos, they have what you call family humor. This is the jokes. They imitate, you know, their cousins, their brothers, their uncles, whatever.
Right.
You know, from Mexico. You know, with the accents and everything else. So this was the kind of humor. It was like family humor. Cheech didn't want to share. You know, and I told him, I said, "Come on, man. You know, we have to. You know, we're agreed. You know, we're. You know, we have to." And I says, "If it's funny, you know, that's all that counts." And so he says, "Okay." And he showed me the bit. You know, hey man, what's happening? Oh, I said, "Oh, perfect." So there was an old black comedy routine that I remembered from, you know, my days with Motown, where I would watch these black comedians, and this one black comedian did a bit called the date. he'd be driving a car and he'd stop. First of all, he'd clean up his car. You know, he'd do a funny pantomime of cleaning his car up, making it all nice, and then he'd go pick up his date and he'd get the date in the car. And so when Cheech showed me, you know, told me about the character, I kind of showed him the bit, you know, especially the bit about polishing the car. And then I said, and you pick me up. I'm a hitchhiker, and I'll be the stoner. I'll be like the stoner hitchhiker. And Cheech says, okay. So we went on stage that night, and we did it, the second show. And as soon as Cheech says, hey, Red Freak, want a ride, man? As soon as he said that, man, the joint just, it was like electricity. The whole place just roared. They recognized his character. That was pure L.A. And from that point on, man, that character was like 50, a good, started out maybe 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and then it became like 75% of the show. And then eventually 100%.
Hey, Red Freak, wanna ride, man? Hey, man, come on in. Hey, what's happening? Hey.
Oh, yeah, man.
Close that door, man. Hey, man, as soon as the light change, we go, okay?
Yeah, thanks a lot for stopping.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Cool, man. Hey, I pick up PPC checking all the time, man.
Far
hey,
out,
hey, you like my car, man?
Oh, yeah, man. I really like the dingo balls, man.
Yeah, it would have been myself, man. Yeah, hey, man, did you notice the name as you came in here?
The name, man?
Yeah, the name of the car.
Oh, no.
It's La Bamba, eh? La Bamba,
yeah. Far out.
Hey, man. Like, wow, man.
Hey, man, how far you going, man?
In the end of the block, man. You know.
Oh, hey, man, take it easy, man. You act like you got some dope on you, man. You don't got no dope on you, do you?
Oh, no, man. I never get.
Oh, hey, well, if you don't, man, I do. Here, light this up.
Oh, far out, man.
Oh, wow, well, it's a really good stuff, too, man.
Talking to Tommy Chaw, he's got a book out called I Chaw, Meditations from the Joint. In 85, you and Cheech split up.
Yeah.
And to quote you, Cheech was closer than a wife. The only thing we didn't do was have sex. It was like a death in the family. I don't know if I'll ever get over it, was your
That's
quote
true.
At the time.
That's
now,
true.
What
true.
Did he tell you? Because it was his idea. What did he tell you? Why?
It was kind of a weird kind of chicken shit way of doing it. I had no idea he resented the fact that I directed. You know, I had control. And I had, and I needed control, you know, in order to get what I did, what I got out of him. But he just didn't want to be that guy anymore. He wanted to show the world, you know, that he was much more intelligent than you know, that dumb Chicano.
The Beaner, right.
The Beaner, yeah, that kind of thing, you know. Because even in the Corsican Brothers, you know, there's a part in the Corsican Brothers where I'm a revolutionary.
Right.
And she says, well, you know, why do you have to be a revolutionary all the time, man? Why can't you just, you know, just be normal? You know, why do you have, and, you know, and I always, you know, and I was always on the edge. And he got tired of living on the edge. And so he just wanted out. He wanted out. And there's no other way around it.
How did that
happen? He wrote a song called Born in East L.A., you know.
Right.
And then what's his name? Frank Price, the president of Columbia. They, him and Cheech got together and they decided, well, hey, why don't we do a movie without Chong? And they did. And that broke the string. That broke a lot of things. It broke my heart because, you know, I always made sure that Cheech was, you know, like he had the funniest lines. I made sure that he had the
Yeah, you were
billing,
the basic, you were
billing.
The straight man to him 90% of the time.
Yeah.
Well, of course, they say, though, it takes a lot of talent to be a great straight man. I
mean. Well, it's just restraint, you know, just know. I've got a built-in respect for audiences, and I think that's what directors, you know, natural directors have. You know, when they do a project, they know, they see it through the audience eyes, and that's what I've always done since I was 10 years old playing music. You know, the fiddle player used to tell me, you know, give the people what they want, and don't be out there too long. And if they want the same song over and over again, give it to them. That's what they want to hear. And that was always been my credo. And to this day, it's still the same. Cheech, on the other hand, he didn't want to, you know, he wanted to move on. You know, Cheech gets bored real easy. And so, you know, oh, he was bored with doing this. I want to do something else. And you can see, you know, with his acting, you know, he went with Don Johnson, you know, he did the Tin Cup. He did, you know, he did a lot of, you know, diverse characters. And, you know, he's still, and he's, you know, Cars, voiceover with Cars. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got a busy little guy. He's a busy little guy.
Would you have done anything without him?
Before the breakup, you mean?
Yeah.
No. I got offered a directing job, which I took, but I would never do anything in front of a camera without Cheech.
Really?
Until I was forced to. And then even then, after, you know, like I did Far Out Man, and I had him play a cameo, you know, I wanted him to be in it more, but he said no. He says, it's over. It's gone.
Hey, man, which one of you guys is the DJ?
That's me, Wink Dickerson from KRUT Radio.
Oh, Far Out, dang. Hey,
no,
listen,
no, that's
man.
Wink. Wink Dickerson from KRUT Radio.
Oh, yeah, well, Far Out. Listen, man, do you want to give me your name, man? I'm supposed to introduce you after the next act, dig?
Yeah, well, like I said, it's Wink Dickerson from KRUT Radio.
Yeah, dig.
Perhaps you've caught my show, Wink's Wax to Watch, on Saturday from 12 to 1.
No, man, I'm really not into AM.
Oh, I see. You know, well, remember, it's 11,111 on your radio dial.
Oh, yeah, man, I'll write that down. I think my sister listens to you once.
Oh, Far Out.
So listen, man, are you ready to go on?
Right on.
Oh, yeah. Far Out, man. Okay, man, I'm going to go out and announce you now. You ready?
Sure, I'm ready anytime you are. Don't forget, it's Wink Dinkerson from KRUT.
All right, testing. Hey, is this thing on? Testing. Is this thing on? Can you hear me back there? Yeah, well, then shut up, all right? Hey, listen, I'm supposed to introduce the guy that's going to bring on the next act. Can you hear me out there? Oh, well, then shut up. Hey, now listen. Can we have a round of applause? Hey, get off the stage. Hey, do you want to get off the stage? You guys want to shut up? Listen, we want a round of applause for a DJ who's going to introduce the next act. Okay, can we hear it for Dink Winkerson from KRUD Radio?
Hi there, groovy guys, groovy girls, peace, love, dope. Beads, bells, incense, light shows, crash pads, and Hare Krishna, all you groovy freaks. Dig it right on, and power to the people. Great kids having a good time tonight. Far Out and solid. Listen, before we bring out this next act, I just want to say that you kids are really great tonight, and let's have a good time and keep it clean, huh, kids? All right, here comes the next act. He's the fastest rising blues singer on the circuit today. He is the man responsible for that upcoming hit, Going Downtown, Gonna See My Gal. Let's give a big warm welcome for Blind Melon Shetland.
We're talking to Tommy Chong. Let's move on to television, because you've done a lot of TV.
Yeah.
Most memorable, or one of the more memorable roles, is on the 70s show, which did for several years. We had to stop and do a little prison time there, but other than that, played Leo. How did they treat you on that set? Were you like an icon to those guys?
I was, well, not so much to the actors, but to the writers and to the... to the old guys, I remember a lot of the crew guys were cameramen in that when we did Up in Smoke and all the movies.
Really?
So I knew those guys from back in the day, you know, when they were young kids. It was great. The writers and the producers and that, they were great, you know. But you know, they're so straight, you know. And Fox had everybody so worried about, you know, being politically correct, you know, so they wouldn't let me do anything, you know. I couldn't get it, you know. I'd try to ad lib a little bit, and they'd shut it down.
Isn't it weird that you're well known for, you know, being a stoner? Okay, I still consider that contemporary humor, because it's recent, but yet it's been around long enough to where the crew, some of them don't know who you are. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Well, the kids, it was more than anything, it was the kids that didn't know.
You also were on The Simpsons, of course, and in South Park selling the Cherokee hair tampons.
That was their best.
That's a great show. Tommy Chong has written a book called I, Chong, Operation Pipe Dreams, which was the government's crackdown on, I guess for some reason, there's a great fear of paraphernalia sales. But the website that was selling paraphernalia that you got busted for wasn't really yours, was it?
No, it was my son's, and it was entrapment, pure entrapment. They set up, the DEA set up a phony head shop in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, and they tried for almost a year to get us to send them bongs across the mail, across the state line, and we wouldn't do it because, my son's company knew better. And so I'm pretty sure that they put an undercover agent into the shop because the guy ended up, the guy flew, the agents flew to L.A., bought the bongs, $5,000 worth, and they had the agent ship it, and that broke the law. And what they did, they were, instead of coming after me, they said, listen, if you don't give up, we're going to make you a deal. If you don't take the deal, we're going to go after your son and your wife, because my wife signed a check for the money to start the business.
And that's why you took the 9 months, right?
And that's why I did the 9 months, yeah.
You would have to presume that they were after you because of your image, and they thought you'd be a great example of some kind.
Well, they thought a lot of things. They thought for sure that I really was that stoner guy. They thought I would have a lot of prior arrests, so that would be a slam dunk when it came down to, it was a weapons of mass destruction theory, They thought for sure that I would have a lot of priors. I mean, 68 years old or 66 at the time. So, and what they did, they found out I had none. I was clean as a whistle. I was surprised me, man. I had to go back and check again, Are you sure? I had no priors, and so they still put me in jail.
I understand one of the things that really pissed you off was their argument about drugs, paraphernalia, supporting terrorism. They always bring that up.
They say that we're making billions of dollars. Billions of dollars. I mean, it's so ridiculous. Then it's not when you think of that you think of the industries that the drug war supports, like the prison industry. All the prisons, all the federal prisons are privately owned, and all the garments that people buy for the prisons, that's privately owned. It's Halliburton. And then they got, they got this war on drugs. The DEA, I mean, they get billions of dollars from the government to fight this non-existent war on drugs.
Well, you says here when you were in prison, you were a friendly con. What does that mean? They liked you? Is that as simple as that? They just liked you and left you
alone?
Well,
the thing is about prison, if you want to do your time and get out of there really quick, you have to be super nice. You have to be, you can't give any attitude. Everything depends on attitude, even the way you look at them. If they tell you to move and you don't move right away, they consider that, you're a bad attitude. And if you got a bad attitude, they can keep you in jail for as long as they want. There's been guys in jail, man. There's been guys. I've seen guys with release papers signed by judges, and they're still in jail because the Bureau of Prisons, they forgot, they lost that paperwork.
Right.
They just don't feel like letting the guy out. You got no protection. There's no one on your side. I mean, it's up to them. They decide whether you where you live, what you eat, everything. And so the best way to do it, do your time, is to act weird and stay out of the eye line, stay out of sight, and always give give a nice vibe.
So you didn't have to be anybody's bitch while you were in there?
Well, that's all a fallacy, Mm-hmm. The truth is, man, all that Bubba stuff and that, it's all it's not true. It doesn't hurt.
You braggart. You ain't no fucking looker, I'll tell you that.
No one hit on me. I felt kind of bad about it. The barber was gay, and he never even hit on me. No one hit on me, man. I felt really
bad. You're crushed.
About it. Right. Yeah, I was kind of, but then, I'm an old guy, so I can understand.
You lost your ass in the 90s, right?
Yeah, long time ago.
Yeah, but while you were in there, you read the I Ching, and consequently, you decided to write some of your own, and that's the book.
That's
which is how called I Chong, Meditations from the Joint. It says, when you have dignity, Says Tommy Chong, you have respect. And, sir, you just got my respect. You always have, as a matter of fact.
Thank you.
You're great. Tommy, many more years.
Thanks, brother.
And thanks for all the great, great times you brought us.
My pleasure.
Tommy Chong and the story of Cheech and Chong. I'm Sonny Fox. Hope you enjoyed that. I sure did. But next week, another one, number 8. Won't tell you who it is. Just tune in next week and find out. I'm sure you're going to love it. Thanks for listening.